Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of August 29th, 2013. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. This week marks the fifth and final week of our special summer series devoted to the ongoing investigation by independent researchers into the attacks of September 11th, 2001. In previous installments of this series, we have heard presentations from a number of distinguished academics and researchers which provide detailed information discrediting the official explanation of the attacks popularly known as the 9/11 terrorist attacks. These presentations, and the ones you are about to hear, were excerpted from a conference convened at Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada, which was recorded and is available to the public as a 330-minute video called The Toronto Hearings on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception. A DVD copy of the video is available for purchase at the website globalresearch.ca. Kevin Ryan is a chemist and was the laboratory manager fired from his position with a subsidiary of Underwriters Laboratories for publicly questioning the National Institute on Standards and Technology account of the World Trade Center collapses. His presentation on the inadequacies of the NIST account appeared earlier in this summer series. In this second talk, conducted on day three of the Toronto hearings, Ryan focuses on the evidence of much higher temperatures in the presence of the Trade Center debris than acknowledged in the NIST findings.
Today, I'm going to present evidence related to the existence of unusually high temperatures at the World Trade Center, both during the destruction of the three buildings and afterward for several months. Much of the evidence presented here will be taken from two peer-reviewed scientific papers. One of these papers is called Extremely High Temperatures During the World Trade Center Destruction. The authors include four PhD physicists, one PhD chemist, and several others, including myself. The second of the two papers I'll discuss is called Environmental Anomalies at the World Trade Center, Evidence for Energetic Materials. I'd like to begin with the first of these papers and ask you to notice the maximum temperatures that were cited by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, at the World Trade Center. NIST reported gas temperatures as high as 1,000 degrees Celsius within its report on the World Trade Center destruction. It's important to note that these are gas temperatures, not the temperatures of solid materials. But one problem with the maximum temperatures cited by officials is that there are many eyewitnesses who claim that metal had been melted at the World Trade Center, and we know that could not have resulted from these temperatures. Here are just a few of the eyewitness statements that were made. The first one is from a man who worked for John Skilling, the design engineer of the World Trade Center towers. He said, "As of 21 days after the attack, the fires were still burning and molten steel was still running. A chaplain at Ground Zero said, I talked to many contractors and they said they actually saw molten metal trapped. Beams had just totally been melted because of the heat." Dr. Keith Eaton of the Institute of Structural Engineers said, "I was shown slides of molten metal, which was still red hot weeks after the event." Another doctor from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health said, "In some pockets now being uncovered, they're finding molten steel."
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel. Molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Yeah. Like lava.
Like lava.
From a volcano.
But on the left here, you see molten metal pouring from the South Tower and being pulled from the debris pile at Ground Zero, the World Trade Center site. NIST said that they found no evidence of molten metal. But NIST said if molten metal had been present, it would have had to have been aluminum from the plane. This was not the case, as one can see from these photographs. On the right, you see the difference between molten iron or steel, which is yellow-orange, and molten aluminum, which is silvery-gray when poured in the daylight. The temperature required to melt steel is 1,538 degrees Celsius. And it's far above the maximum gas temperature cited in the official report. So the solid temperature, evidence for solid temperatures, are much higher than what officials say the gas temperatures were. In a structural fire, steel temperatures lag behind gas temperatures for a number of reasons, including the thermal conductivity of steel, the effects of convection, and the fireproofing that's applied. Achieving a steel temperature of 1,538 degrees Celsius at the World Trade Center would require gas temperatures that are well above 1,538 degrees Celsius and far above the maximum of 1,000 degrees Celsius cited in the official U.S. government World Trade Center reports. This and other indications demonstrate that the NIST reports do not address the evidence. I've seen evidence of the previously molten metal myself in the form of metallic microspheres that I've found in nearly all the nearly dozen World Trade Center dust samples that I've examined. Here are photomicrographs that I took of the first examples that I received in 2007. And we extract particles from the samples of World Trade Center dust. After realizing that such findings could be used in a legal proceeding at some point in the future, we began asking that samples collected by these independent sources be accompanied by documentation that recorded the date, time, and other necessary information, including sample location. Each sample was provided with this information, as well as the signature of the collector, and sometimes a witness as well. The process evolved into the use of a standard chain of custody form, which I've used for many years myself as a laboratory manager. I've extracted the metallic microspheres and other paramagnetic particles from the dust in several ways. On the left here, you can see what the content of a typical World Trade Center dust sample looks like under a microscope. These photos are at 100x. On the right are photomicrographs of particles that were extracted with a magnet from the bulk of the same World Trade Center dust sample. At the top of that, you can see the many metallic-looking microspheres and other droplet-shaped metallic particles. Below that are examples of red chip-like materials and other metal-looking objects. If we look at the first of the two peer-reviewed scientific papers I mentioned, it begins with a discussion of these metallic microspheres, as well as the finding of semi-transparent silicate-rich microspheres. The paper addresses two independently collected samples that were received for this study. Both samples were collected indoors and shortly after September 11, 2001. One sample was collected on an indoor windowsill on September 14, 2001, just 3 days after the disaster, while search for survivors was going on, and in a building 4 blocks from ground zero. The other sample was acquired inside a fourth floor apartment whose upper windows broke during the World Trade Center collapse a few days later. How were such microspheres formed? As with water falling or spraying through the air, molten metal forms spheres due to surface tension. When a liquid is falling or sprayed through the air, the molecules at the surface do not have other like molecules all around them, and consequently they cohere more strongly to each other, those directly associated on the surface. The United States Geological Survey found the same iron and silicate spheres throughout the World Trade Center dust and could not find an explanation. Our paper explains that the spheres indicate not only that the iron or silicate was molten at one point, but that due to the small size of the spheres, a violent disturbance of some kind would have been necessary to shatter the molten metal into the small size as seen. Various explosive or incendiary processes are likely explanations. Our research team, led by Dr. Stephen Jones and Dr. Jeffrey Farrar at Brigham Young University, analyzed the metallic microspheres we found in World Trade Center dust by a technique called X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy, or XEDS. This is a technique that provided the elemental composition of the spheres. In other words, it told us what elements the spheres were composed of. The result was that the spheres we found were very high in iron and low in other elements. This agreed with the findings of the R.J. Lee group You can see the trace in the lower section on the left from R.J. Lee and how it matches with the trace on the right from our team. The temperatures required to explain this evidence, listed here, cannot be explained by the temperatures given in the official reports on the World Trade Center. To provide even more corroboration for these findings, we need only look to the official U.S. government report that preceded the current one published by NIST. The first report was from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. Appendix C of their report provided strong evidence of extremely high temperatures at the World Trade Center in the form of highly corroded and eroded steel samples saved from the buildings after they were destroyed. FEMA described samples of steel that had been thinned to razor sharpness. In some cases, there were inexplicable holes in the steel. The fire engineering professors who found the samples could not come up with an explanation for it. They also could not explain the sulfidation of the steel. That is, steel had been chemically changed at the microstructural level in ways that indicated a chemical eutectic mixture had been achieved between sulfur, iron, and oxygen, causing steel to melt. Other evidence for extremely high temperatures at the World Trade Center site include the finding of fused metal and concrete artifacts, like the meteorite, as it's called. This is a mass of molten steel and concrete found at the site, all fused into one big chunk. It also includes the thermal hotspots measured by NASA remote sensing instruments that measure temperature via electromagnetic radiation emitted from the surface. Surface temperatures in the debris piles were found to be as high as 750 degrees Celsius a week after 9/11. As you've heard already today, there's an explanation for all this officially unexplained evidence. This explanation is that the thermite reaction was present and occurring at the World Trade Center on 9/11 and afterward in the pile at the World Trade Center site. The thermite reaction is an extremely exothermic chemical reaction between aluminum powder and a metal oxide. The metal oxide is typically iron oxide, which you can see here on the left with a reddish color. The temperature at which thermite burns approaches 3,000 degrees Celsius for some mixtures, which would explain the evidence discussed so far in this testimony. The products of an aluminum iron oxide thermite mixture are molten iron and aluminum oxide, which quickly forms a white dust cloud as it cools. Additives like sulfur improve the burn properties of thermite. And again, a sulfur-containing thermite, which is called thermate, as Mr. Cole mentioned, would explain the evidence found by the FEMA investigators. I've made nanothermite myself via formulations published by the U.S. National Laboratories. On the left here, you see a photomicrograph I took of a particle extracted from the World Trade Center dust. On the right is a photomicrograph of a nanothermite material that I made. And below that's a photo of the ignition of that nanothermite. And I'd like to show you again a short video. But basically, nanothermite is a solution-made thermite. It's iron chloride dissolved in organic solvents. We add a propylene oxide scavenger material, which turns that into iron oxide. And then you can add organic compounds to this solution. And the important thing is that the organic compounds generate gas when the material is ignited that does pressure volume work and makes it explosive, generates gas. Of course, aluminum is added as well. If we take just a couple grams of this nanothermite and put it in a smaller beaker on a hot plate and raise the hot plate to its maximum temperature, which is 550 degrees Celsius, this should cause the material to ignite. We'll add a loose lid to the beaker to demonstrate the pressure volume work effects that the expanding gas should produce. Even with this very small quantity, it should ignite and ignite rapidly and cause explosive gas effects that can be seen. Let's look at it again. As expected, we did see rapid ignition, less than a second to ignite at all, and rapid gas expansion. When we look, this is an important point, when we look at the ignition residues, they're strikingly similar to the appearance of the World Trade Center dust particles that were extracted with a magnet from the bag. Both are the same colors, they show the same metallic microspheres, and both exhibit the same kind of vesicular formations that suggest high temperature reactions or explosive effects. There was a huge dust cloud that arose from the destruction of the buildings. Again, you've heard about this. It was similar to that of a volcano. In other words, it was a pyroclastic-like cloud and appeared to be driven, therefore, by energy sources that exceeded the energy available from the gravitational collapse. Another striking fact is that the dust cloud was very hot and was burning people and setting objects on fire. Here are photos of the many vehicles that were set on fire or burned in the area. There were also many witnesses to the cloud being very hot and burning people as it passed by. Includes Thomas Spinard from the New York Fire Department said the dust cloud hit us, it got real hot, it felt like it was going to light up. Another man said a hot, solid black wave of heat threw him down the block. Another said a hot, billowing cloud of death chased us through the narrow streets of Lower Manhattan. In conclusion, I think this is the evidence that needs to be considered. There are photographs and witness testimony of molten metal at the World Trade Center. This cannot be explained by the temperatures given by the official reports. There clearly were extremely high temperatures evidenced by metallic and other microspheres, evaporated metal and silicates in the World Trade Center dust. FEMA reported findings of eroded steel and sulfidation, which have not been explained officially. NASA provided images of high surface temperatures, again not explained. Fires could not be put out at the World Trade Center site. There were unusual spikes in volatile organic chemical emissions, suggesting abrupt violent fires on specific dates, and unusual species in the environmental monitoring data also corresponding to specific dates, suggesting the presence of thermitic materials. There were high temperature problems noted by the University of California Davis team. And there are similarities, again, throughout all of this to products of thermate and nanothermite. These vehicles were burned as if something passing through the cloud was setting them on fire. And there were many witness testimonies to a hot wind and cloud. So thank you.
Lori Manuel is a PhD candidate in behavioral neuroscience and toxicology at the University of Guelph. She contributed to a special issue of the journal American Behavioral Scientist devoted to what are called state crimes against democracy, or SCADs, and to psychological resistance to embracing alternative accounts of such events. This paper was the basis of her presentation on the final day of the Toronto hearings.
Of war and humanity and the utter madness of militarism, Dr. Martin Luther King had this to say more than 40 years ago about his responsibility to challenge his own government regarding its war on Vietnam. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in a time of war. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. I'm here to speak to you about the betrayal of truth that still continues today and to break the silence about events that present a profound challenge to our most closely guarded beliefs about government and democracy. The public's attention must be brought to bear upon the state crimes against democracy related to the events of September 11th, 2001. These events collectively are referred to as state crimes against democracy, or SCADs. State crimes against democracy are actions which are undertaken in direct violation of sworn oaths of office by officials in order to circumvent, exploit, undermine or subvert laws, the constitutional order, or the public awareness essential to popular control of government. SCADs are dangerous to democracy because they are not isolated events, but a pattern of actions, or in some cases, inactions, which facilitate a progression towards closing down an open and free society into a police state run by a select few. Although there are many theories as to why some people refuse to look at evidence that the official account is false, they're not all equally valid theories. It is neither valid nor accurate to claim that just because a person will not examine evidence that the official account is false, that they are simply in denial. The human brain is the most complex organism in the body, and thus the mechanisms by which the mind processes, interprets, and responds to information is equally complex. For example, the human brain is composed of hundreds of billions of neurons, each with thousands of synapses, creating a vastly complex and intricate neural network consisting of up to 100 trillion to up to a quadrillion synaptic connections. At any one time, this organ is processing an infinite amount of information, both from its internal and external environment, most of which we are unconscious of. However, it is often that information, of which we are largely unaware, that has the most significant influence over our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. Even those thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that we adamantly believe to be consciously determined. We assume that when we are looking at something, we are consciously analyzing it based upon the visual information that is entering the brain from the eyes. But this is not entirely accurate. In fact, visual stimuli transduced by the rods and cones in the eyes and sent by electrochemical signals to the central nervous system via the optic nerves does not go directly to the occipital cortex, which is the primary region responsible for processing visual information. Instead, it first goes to the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus, another region of the brain that is a part of the limbic system and important to emotional arousal. To put this in simpler terms, this means that you can experience an emotional reaction to something before you are consciously aware that you have even seen it, which in turn then affects how you see it. Alternative explanations of political assassinations, terrorist attacks, and other national tragedies that differ from official state accounts are sometimes dismissed by the general public because they evoke strong cognitive dissonance, a psychological phenomenon which occurs when new ideas or information conflict with previously formed ideologies and accepted beliefs. In psychology, a false belief generally refers to one that has been manipulated, often purposely and outside of the person's awareness, and sometimes in a very specific direction or misdirection. An elegant and robust example comes from the work of Solomon Asch in the 1940s and Harold Kelly in the 1950s, and later replicated by others, including Neil Widmeyer and John Loy in the late 1980s. And Widmeyer and Loy's paper is the one that I'm going to be focusing on. This experimental manipulation of beliefs is referred to as the warm-cold effect. In a classroom setting, students in Widmeyer and Loy's experiment were given different introductions to a visiting professor and later asked to describe the professor and his lecturing abilities. But before the professor appeared, half of the students were informed that he was a rather cold person, and the other half were informed that he was a rather warm person. In addition, students in both groups were also told that he was either a professor of physical education or a professor of social psychology. All the students experienced the exact same lecture, which was delivered in a very neutral manner. Okay? The results showed that students who were led to believe that the lecturer was a warm person not only reported that he was much more likable than students led to believe he was a cold person, they also reported that he was a more competent teacher. This is an example of a false belief because the liking or disliking and the perceptions of competency and incompetency arose from the warm or cold introduction and not from the professor's actual mannerisms or methods of teaching, which were all identical for students. Most importantly, the information regarding the professor's area of expertise as either a professor of physical education or social psychology had no effect on students' perceptions. Now, this experimental example has real-world consequences for a functioning democracy, such as when people can be manipulated, for example, by the media, into falsely believing that they like or dislike a presidential candidate because of his or her public policy, when in fact the perception arises solely from the media's framing of the candidate merely as likable or dislikable. The issue of competency to hold the highest position of public office does not even need to factor into the equation. The use of repression and terror, including threats of censorship, suppression of information, imprisonment, and torture by leaders to silence political opponents and dissidents, is not exclusive to authoritarian states. Such tactics can also be employed by leaders of democratic states, a fact that can be difficult for people to acknowledge, especially if it is not consistent with their belief system. We must be ever vigilant of the motives of leaders who would persuade us to surrender our property, liberty, and humanity, one priceless piece at a time. How can we do this? First and foremost, by educating ourselves and our fellow citizens on how we, the people, can be manipulated by our government and its lapdog news media into forfeiting our civil liberties and duties. We need to challenge the long-standing and often erroneous assumptions about the role of government, public discourse, and dissent in democratic societies. And we can start by identifying some of the social psychological factors that can prevent people from examining evidence of crimes committed by the state. Although some people may harbor cynicism about bureaucrats and politicians, most do not want to believe that public officials in general, and especially those at the highest office, would participate in election tampering, assassinations, mass murder, or other high crimes, especially in democratic societies. For example, although public cynicism towards government was high in the months prior to 9/11, trust in U.S. officials in Washington rose significantly. It more than doubled to 64% in the weeks following the terrorist attacks, suggesting that heightened focus on national security breeds support for incumbent foreign policymakers. Claims that state intelligence and other officials within democratic states could conspire with criminal elements to kill innocent civilians are difficult for citizens of those states to comprehend, even when backed by substantial evidence. Evidence that U.S. officials have used the attacks of 9/11 as a means to manipulate the mass public into accepting two major wars of aggression has been dangerously ignored by mainstream media and academia until recently. Protecting democracy demands that citizens must be made aware of how they can be manipulated by government and media into forfeiting their civic liberties and duties. Information vital to protecting citizens from crimes against democracy orchestrated by the state, as history has repeatedly demonstrated, can happen particularly in times of disaster, collective shock, and national threat. I want to end with one important quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, who I opened up with, that is just imperative today and perhaps even more so than when he said it. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter, but beautiful, struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the sons of God, and our brothers wait eagerly for our response. Shall we say the odds are too great? Shall we tell them the struggle is too hard? Will our message be that the forces of American life militate against their arrival as full men, and we send our deepest regrets? Or will there be another message of longing, of hope, of solidarity with their yearnings, of commitment to their cause, whatever the cost? The choice is ours, and though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. Thank you.
You're listening to a special summer broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on participating community radio stations across Canada. We are also heard on the Progressive Radio Network and our podcast at globalresearch.ca. David Ray Griffin is a distinguished philosopher and theologian, spending much of his career at the Claremont School of Theology. He's been the author, co-author, or editor of over 24 books on theological or philosophical subjects. He has since 2004 authored, co-authored, or edited 12 books on 9/11, including The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, which was named a Publisher's Weekly Pick of the Week in 2008. He has also twice been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. On the fourth and final day of the hearings, Griffin spoke on the anomalies in Flights 77 and 93.
I begin with a question. Is the 9/11 Commission's new story about American 77 believable? One of the things that we would not have expected, on the assumption that we have been told the truth about American 77, is that 3 years after 9/11, the original official story about this flight would be replaced with a radically different story. According to the original story, told in a press release of September 18, 2001, called NORAD's Response Times, NORAD was notified about American 77 at 9:24 that morning, roughly 14 minutes before the Pentagon was officially hit. This report raised a difficult question for the military. Why were the F-16s from Langley Air Force Base, about 130 miles away, not able to get to the Pentagon in time to prevent the attacks? In their 2006 book, the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Kane and Lee Hamilton, wrote, "If the military had had the amount of time they said they had, it was hard to figure out how they failed to shoot down the plane." The 9/11 Commission would avoid this conclusion by providing a new story, according to which the FAA had not told the military about American 77 at 9:24. In fact, the Commission claimed it never did notify the military until the Pentagon had been struck. This new official story of 2004 by the 9/11 Commission got the military off the hook for not preventing the attack on the Pentagon. But this new story is not believable for many reasons. The FAA's Air Traffic Control Center in Indianapolis was handling the flight when it started showing signs of being in trouble. The 9/11 Commission claims that the Indianapolis Center did not notify the military even when, at 8:56, it lost this flight's transponder signal, its radar track, and its radio. Why? Because the Indianapolis controller concluded, the 9/11 Commission claimed, that American 77 had experienced serious electrical or mechanical failure after which it crashed. Why would the controller have made this conclusion at this time when it was known that two planes had already been hijacked, one of which had crashed into the World Trade Center? Because, the Commission claimed, no one at Indianapolis had any knowledge of the situation in New York until 9:20. But this claim strains credulity. Television networks had started broadcasting images of the World Trade Center at 8:48. These images included, at 9:03, the crash of the second airliner into the South Tower. Millions of people knew about these events. How can we believe that no one at the Indianapolis Center had any knowledge of the situation in New York until 9:20? General Mike Canavan, director of Civil Aviation Security, told the 9/11 Commission, "As soon as you know you had a hijacked aircraft, you notify everyone. The notification gets broadcast out to all the regions." According to the 9/11 Commission report, Dick Cheney entered the bunker under the White House, technically the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, shortly before 10 o'clock, perhaps at 9:58. However, according to virtually all reports, including statements by Richard Clark and David Bohr, Cheney's photographer, Cheney had entered the PEOC closer to 9:15 a.m. The most important of these reports came from Norman Mineta, who was the Secretary of Transportation. In testimony to the 9/11 Commission, Mineta said that he arrived at the PIOC at about 9:20 a.m., shortly after which he overheard the ongoing conversation involving Cheney, which occurred during the time that the airplane was coming into the Pentagon. Mineta said, "There was a young man who would come in and say to the Vice President, 'The plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out.' And when it got down to 'The plane is 10 miles out,' the young man also said to the Vice President, 'Do the orders still stand?' And the Vice President turned and whipped his neck around and said, 'Of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?'" What were the orders? Mineta assumed, he said, that they were orders to have the aircraft shot down. But no aircraft approaching Washington was shot down. Mineta's interpretation also made the young man's question unintelligible, given the fact that the airspace over the Pentagon is categorized as forbidden, meaning that commercial aircraft are never permitted in it, plus the fact that the two hijacked planes had already crashed into the Twin Towers. The expected orders, if an unidentified plane were approaching the airspace, would have been to shoot it down. Had Cheney given those orders, there would have been no reason for the young man to ask if the orders still stood. His question made sense only if the orders were to do something unexpected, not to shoot it down. The most natural interpretation of Mineta's story, accordingly, was that he had inadvertently reported that he heard Cheney confirm stand-down orders. This interpretation would also make sense of what the 9/11 Commission did in response to Mineta's story. Its report did not mention Mineta's story, and its claim that Cheney entered the PIOC shortly before 10 o'clock meant that there was no time for the exchange with the young man described by Mineta. This portion of Mineta's testimony was also removed from the Commission's video archive. Mineta's testimony, combined with the 9/11 Commission's reaction to it, provides strong evidence, convincing to at least most members of the truth movement, that Washington insiders, including Cheney, were behind the Pentagon attack. The official story is rendered especially dubious by its claim that the Pentagon was struck by a Boeing 757 flown by Al-Qaeda's Hani Hanjour. As the title of a New York Times story revealed in 2002, Hanjour, who had been taking lessons in a single-engine plane, was known as a trainee noted for incompetence, about whom an instructor said he could not fly at all. And yet on September 11, 2001, before Hanjour had been declared by authorities to have been the pilot of the plane that hit the Pentagon, a Washington Post story said, "Just as the plane seemed to be on a suicide mission into the White House, the unidentified pilot executed a pivot so tight that it reminded observers of a fighter jet maneuver. Aviation sources said the plane was flown with extraordinary skill." A Post story the following year stated, "Aviation experts concluded that the final maneuver, American Flight 77, was the work of a great talent." This was clearly impossible. Moreover, the extraordinary maneuver would have been so difficult in a 757 that the official story could not be saved by simply choosing a less incompetent Al-Qaeda trainee. Ralph Kolstad, who was a top U.S. Navy pilot before becoming a commercial airline pilot, has said, "I have 6,000 miles of flight time in Boeing 757s and 767s, and I could not have flown it the way the path was described. If the maneuver could not have been executed by a 757, by one of America's top pilots, it could not have been executed by one of the alleged hijackers." Turning now to United Flight 93. There were contradictory reports. In 2003, NORAD officials told the 9/11 Commission that the FAA reported a possible hijack of United Flight 93 at 9:16. But the 9/11 Commission in 2004 called this incorrect, saying instead, by 10:03, when United 93 crashed in Pennsylvania, there had been no mention to the military of its hijacking. The FAA controller in Cleveland had detected signs of hijacking at 9:28, even hearing, "We have a bomb on board." And yet Cleveland reportedly did not connect the military. The 9/11 Commission, trying to explain why not, gave an account of incompetence and even stupidity in the FAA, which is unbelievable. Besides being unbelievable, the 9/11 Commission's claim was contradicted by many prior reports. In his 2004 book, Richard Clark said that during his White House video conference, FAA Administrator Jane Garvey reported that at about 9:35, a number of potential hijacks, which included United 93 over Pennsylvania, had occurred. And this conversation occurred while both Donald Rumsfeld and General Richard Myers had been listening. The 9/11 Commission was able to claim that the military was able to deny that the military had learned about Garvey's report by simply denying that Rumsfeld and Myers were involved in this video conference. An ABC program on the first anniversary of 9/11 had Karl Rove, David Bohrer, Cheney's photographer, and Cheney himself discussing the hijacked United 93 as having been considered the biggest threat. Brigadier General Montague Winfield, who had taken a leadership position in the Pentagon's National Military Command Center, recalled, "We received the report from the FAA that Flight 93 had turned off its transponder, had turned, and was now heading towards Washington, D.C." General Larry Arnold, the commander of NORAD's U.S. Continental Region, indicated in a January 2002 interview that the military learned about United 93's troubles between the crash into the second tower and the attack on the Pentagon. "By this time," he said, "we were watching United 93 wander around Ohio." He also said that at 9:24, "our focus was on United 93, which was being pointed out to us very aggressively, I might add, by the FAA." This report by Arnold, who was involved in the events, differed radically from what the 9/11 Commission claimed. It's claimed that the FAA never contacted the military about United 93. Did the military shoot United 93 down? Rumors that the military had shot down Flight 93 existed from the start. Major Daniel Nash, one of the pilots from Otis Air Force Base, sent to fly over New York City, reported that when he returned to base, he was told that a military F-16 had shot down an airliner in Pennsylvania. This rumor became sufficiently widespread that it came up during General Richard Myers' confirmation interview with the Senate Armed Service Committee on September 13th. Chairman Carl Levin saying that there have been statements that the aircraft that crashed in Pennsylvania was shot down, added, "These stories continue to exist." Myers replied, "Mr. Chairman, the armed forces did not shoot down any aircraft." That same day, NORAD said, "Contrary to media reports that speculate that United Airlines Flight 93 was downed by a U.S. Fighter aircraft, NORAD allocated forces have not engaged with weapons any aircraft, including Flight 93. NORAD said that this should put an end to the rumors. But the rumors continued. Although the 9/11 Commission did not directly acknowledge this controversy, it made a three-point argument to rule out the possibility that United 93 could have been shot down. The first argument was that the military did not know about the hijacking of United 93 until after it had crashed. As we have seen, there is much evidence against this claim. The second argument was that Cheney, having not arrived in the PEOC until almost 10 o'clock, did not give the shoot-down authorization until sometime after 10:10, and that Richard Clark, who had asked for this authorization, did not receive confirmation until 10:25. These claims were meant to rule out the possibility that United 93 was shot down because it came down at either 10:03 or 10:06. However, Clark himself indicated that he, after asking for the authorization shortly after 9:30, and he was then amazed at the speed of the decisions coming from Cheney, and he received the authorization between 9:45 and 9:50, not after 10:10. The Pentagon's third argument was that the military was not in position to shoot United 93 down. But a reporter in Nashua, which is where the Boston Aircraft Control Center actually is, wrote, "FAA air traffic controllers in Nashua have learned through discussions with other controllers that the F-16 fighter stayed in hot pursuit of another hijacked commercial airliner until it crashed in Pennsylvania." Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz said, "We responded awfully quickly, and in fact, we were already tracking in on that plane that crashed in Pennsylvania." A CBS story then said, "U.S. officials were considering shooting down the hijacked airliner that crashed in western Pennsylvania, but it crashed first." Administration officials say that had the jetliner continued towards Washington, the fighter jets would have shot it down. The falsity of the official story about 93 is further suggested by descriptions of the alleged crash site. One television reporter said, "There was just a big hole in the ground. All I saw was a crater filled with small, charred plane parts. Nothing that would even tell you that it was the plane. There were no suitcases, no recognizable plane parts, no body parts." A newspaper photographer said, "I didn't think I was in the right place. I was looking for something that said tall, tail, wing, plane, metal. There was nothing." Debris, instead, was found many miles away, and much of it was debris that could not have blown there. John Flegel, an employee at Indian Lake Marina, reported that the debris that washed ashore included pieces of seats, small chunks of melted plastic, and checks. Newspapers reported that debris was found in New Baltimore, which was beyond a mountain ridge more than 8 miles from the alleged crash site. Also, although Flight 93 reportedly was carrying more than 37,000 gallons of fuel when it crashed, tests of soil and groundwater at the official crash site found no evidence of contamination. Perhaps the strangest feature of the crash site was that there were evidently two of them. According to CNN reporter Brian Cabell, speaking from the official crash site, the FBI had cordoned off a second area about 6 to 8 miles away from the crater. He then asked, "Why would debris from the plane be located 6 miles away?" Conclusion. My report shows that there are many anomalous features in the official stories of Flight 77 and 93. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Mm-hmm. Mike Gravel served as U.S. Senator for Alaska from 1969 to 1981. Among his achievements were his efforts to get the Pentagon Papers by Daniel Ellsberg entered into the public record, as well as filibusters geared towards blocking the extension of the military draft during the Vietnam War. He ran as a third-party presidential candidate in 2008 and continues to champion progressive policies on global warming, taxation, healthcare, human rights, and peacemaking. Senator Gravel spoke immediately after Lori Manuel on the subject of the importance of resistance to state deception, the Pentagon Papers and 9/11, and the need for a new investigation.
One of the most important things to understand is, from my point of view, how I got here and why I'm here. Because I don't take the same position of the scientific community that I behold. What I behold is that this knowledge has to get out to the people. And you need an actionable item. And I want to give you one statement about my experience, because I get it all the time. Well, we got to inform the people. We got to do this for the people. Keep in mind, if the people have no vehicle to act upon that information, all you do is create a new generation of cynics. That's all that happens. When you have information, as a citizen, you must have a vehicle to act upon it. The people, without the ability to make law, are disenfranchised. And I tell you that as a politician, because I got elected, several elections, in fact, and I'll tell you very candidly how it works. I get money from special interest. I turn around and manipulate you, my constituency. And after you elect me, I look down at you and say, hell, I'm smarter than all of you. I just fooled you. I got elected. That is the way it works. That is the way it works. And so when people say, I can't believe that our leadership would be so criminal to cause 3,000 deaths, my God, realize that that's what they're always doing. Ever since I've been in public office, the leadership of my country that I love, your country and the world, we've just been killing people wantonly. I came to the conclusion that the answer, and I came to this conclusion totally, I was grappling with it for more than a decade, and that is that the answer lies with the people. Very simple. There's only two venues for change. The government, wherein lies the problem, or the people. The problem is the people don't have the power to act upon the knowledge that they receive and what they continue. So I wrote legislation. It's called the National Initiative. This initiative is a device, meta-legislation. I don't care about the issue. Meta-legislation to empower you to make laws in every government jurisdiction of the United States, and I hope someday in every jurisdiction, government jurisdiction of the world. The people then would come in as partners, full partners with their representatives, who will then be in a position to do a better job in their representation, because we need good leaders, but the people will be the policymakers. And the minute they come into that scene, they are the senior partners. I was there on 9/11 with a three-day funk depression glued to the TV. Now, why did I know right then and there that the fix was in? Well, I knew it. I've been following the military-industrial complex and fighting them for the last 40 years. 9/11 generated three wars: Iraq, Afghanistan, and the most diabolical one of all, which will finance into infinity the military-industrial complex. And that's the war on terror. Because terror was with us at the beginning of civilization, and it will be with us at the end of civilization. Let me reemphasize Cicero's great statement. Keep in mind, when he was around, Cicero said, freedom is participation in power. If you do not make laws, none of you have ever participated in power unless you've been elected to office. I've participated in power, and what I saw was terrible. Was terrible. I've got the backing and the acceptance of this law, which has never been done before, by California, by Oregon, and now by Massachusetts. It's locked in. It's locked in.
Speaking near the end of the hearings was Bob McElvain. Like Lori Van Alken, Mr. McElvain is the family member of a 9/11 victim.
Hello, my name is Bob McElvain. I live in Philadelphia, the suburbs of Philadelphia. My son Bobby, almost 10 years ago, died right here at the site of the North Tower. On September 11th, 2001, Bobby lived up at 66 between 1st and 2nd and took the subway to Fulton Street and walked over from Fulton Street, where he had just started a job at Merrill Lynch. He had just started there like 2-3 weeks before 9/11. And so my assumption is that day, we had no idea what happened to Bobby, but we came up to New York and we did find his body. We took Bobby home that week and buried him on a week later on Tuesday the 18th. For years and years, I've been trying to find out what happened that day. But in the beginning, things were so frantic. You spend almost a year just grieving because you just can't figure out what happened. But I questioned the story of 9/11 immediately, but again, I just wasn't getting involved in that too much. I went to almost 90% of the 9/11 commission hearings. Well, my whole life changed after Condoleezza Rice testified, and I don't call it testimony. As far as the case of Condoleezza Rice, it was a filibuster. They were questioning her about this August 6th memo that Osama bin Laden was supposed to attack the United States. And of course, I assume everyone knows what a filibuster is, but she just talked nonsense. And each commissioner only had 5 minutes to speak up or to ask questions. Well, anyway, that ended. Nothing was said, nothing was done. All the commissioners are Saran and Condoleezza Rice shaking their hands, everyone's smiling. And that's when I lost my cool. It was after that that I did an interview, I was angry, and I've been angry ever since. I realized the investigation was a total sham. And I think everyone in the world knows that the investigation was a total sham. Even the commissioners admit that, some of the commissioners admit that it was a sham. So I've dedicated my life since then to just concentrating on 9/11 truth. You're having hearings up in Toronto. I just think it's such a wonderful thing because it's going to put this information out to hopefully the whole world. And from that, maybe we would have a nonpartisan, objective investigation. We're in a constant war, and it's based on what happened that day, what happened that morning, and these are explosions that took place. So I really wish you luck in Toronto. My spirit is with you, but my family, we're here at Ground Zero every September 11th, so I will be thinking of you, and I just want you all to stay strong and do your thing. Thank you.
On this, the fifth and final week of our special 9/11-themed summer series, we heard presentations from chemist Kevin Ryan, PhD doctoral candidate and behavioral science researcher Lori Manuel, theologian, philosopher, and longtime 9/11 researcher David Ray Griffin, former U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Mike Gravel, and from Bob McElvain, father of a 9/11 victim. These and other presentations from the 2011 conference in Toronto are all available on 330-minute DVD entitled The Toronto Hearings on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception. You may order your own copy by visiting the website globalresearch.ca. The Toronto Hearings on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception was presented by the International Center for 9/11 Studies in collaboration with Press for Truth. It was produced by Stephen Davies, Dan Dix, and Brian Law. Music was by Dan Dix. The executive producer was James Gourley. The producer and host of the Global Research News Hour is me, Michael Welch. Please join us next week when we resume our regular broadcasts.